Welcome to Talking Transfusion. We bring you the latest reviews and evidence in transfusion medicine. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of Talking Transfusion, the Transfusion Evidence Roundup. My name is Dr. Alison Moe, a hematologist from Australia and ISBT lead of the Transfusion Evidence Roundup program. Today in the podcast, we'll be discussing some papers from the October Transfusion Evidence Roundup, which is based around the theme of World Trauma Day. This day is held on the 17th of October, and it aims to raise awareness of the importance of trauma care and prevention. So as part of this roundup, our reviewers have selected the top 10 papers relating to transfusion and trauma, assisted by the ISBT and the Systematic Reviews Initiative. And I just want to take this opportunity to thank our three reviewers for their contributions, Dr. Harriet Tucker from the United Kingdom, Dr. Victor Lin from Australia, and Dr. Amita Radhakrishnan there from India. So the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to take a closer look at some of the top papers and take you through the roundup process. Firstly, I'd like to invite my co-chairs and our three reviewers to introduce themselves. So we'll go around the panel. I'll start with Catherine.
Hi, I'm Catherine Kimber from the Systematic Review Initiative. Look after our evidence libraries, including the Transfusion Evidence Library, where we take our references from.
Hi, I'm Susan Brunskill. I'm the manager of the Systematic Review Initiative in Oxford, and I support the staff who do the evidence libraries.
Thank you, Susan. Now, onto our three reviewers, Harriet.
Hi, thanks, Alison. I'm Harriet Tucker. I'm an emergency medicine and pre-hospital emergency medicine consultant from London.
Thank you. Victor?
Thanks, Alison. Hi, everyone. My name is Victor Lin, and I'm an incoming haematology advanced trainee based at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne, Australia.
Thanks, Victor. And Amita?
Yeah, hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Amita Radhakrishnan Nair. I work as associate professor in the Department of Transfusion Medicine at Sri Chitra Thirunal Institute for Medical Sciences and Technology, Thiruvananthapuram, Kerala, India.
Thanks, everyone. So next I'm going to explain a bit about how we did this roundup. So to start the process off, our team at the Systematic Review Initiative searched for papers relating to transfusion in trauma using the Transfusion Evidence Library. And they found papers dating from January 2023 up until July 2024. And as part of this process, only randomized controlled trials and systematic reviews are included. So they found a total of 80 references split evenly into 40 randomized controlled trials and 40 systematic reviews. So we sent these 80 abstracts to our three reviewers, and they had a look through them, and they shortlisted this down to about 29 abstracts for a round two review. And during the round two review, we had a meeting where our three reviewers, Victor, Amita and Harriet, discussed these abstracts further and then selected out of those 29 papers, 19 papers for full text review. They then critically reviewed these 19 papers and scored them on factors such as clinical relevance, the importance of the paper and the quality of the paper. And that was how they ended up picking the top 10. So the full list of the top 10 papers can be found on the ISBT website. And in addition to that, all ISBT members and Transfusion Evidence Library subscribers should have received an email newsletter with the top 10 listed, as well as a link directing you to the PICO summaries, which are really useful summaries of each paper. So it is a fairly involved process, and we'd like to ask our reviewers what they thought of their experience and this process. Might start with my co-chair to see if she's got any questions. So Catherine, do you have any questions for our reviewers?
So I would like to know what criteria did you use to select the top 10 and narrow it down?
So I guess, as Alison mentioned, the reviewing process was essentially a two-stage process. And in the first stage, we were sent 80 abstracts, including 40 randomized controlled trials and 40 systematic reviews to review, and asked to shortlist 15 abstracts to progress to the second stage. And the criteria that we used, I guess the first thing that I looked at was the clinical currency and the interest of the abstract. Did it fully represent the theme of the roundup? Is the topic it addresses novel and of interest? And is there an important finding that meaningfully informs our clinical practice? And I guess the second thing that we looked at was quality of the study. So for the randomized control trials, we looked at the sample size, whether the design was likely to introduce any significant bias, whether the analysis was performed correctly, and whether the study results are likely to be generalizable. And then afterwards, as Alison mentioned, we met online to discuss each of our top 15 abstracts and selected a total of 29 to progress to the second stage. And then the second stage, we reviewed the full texts and scored them, once again, based on a set of criteria that focused on clinical relevance and study quality. And based on these scores, the 10 papers were ultimately shortlisted for the roundup.
So do you think it was a hard process? Was it an easy to choose the top 10? Amita?
Yeah, I should say it was pretty hard. But the thing is, when you see all these papers, we had CTs and we had systematic reviews. Somewhere on very, often repeated terms such as the tranexamic acid use, the pre-hospital plasma transfusion. So we had many papers on those. So actually we had a difficult time choosing which will be the better paper. So as Victor already said, we looked at the clinical relevance, the recency of the paper, the quality of the statistical analysis, and then we had to come down to a single paper. From each topic, we wanted the variety also to be offered to our readers. So we had to choose from these often repeated terms, we had to often choose a single paper. Yes.
And I might have a question as well. I guess some people in the audience might be interested in participating in the roundup in the future. Is there any advice any of you would give them if they're sort of thinking about it?
I think picking up on what both Victor and Amita said, it was a really educational process because there was such a range of papers within arguably the same topic. So I think it really highlighted the breadth and depth of research in this area and how much time and effort is going into answer questions across the whole gamut of transfusion in trauma. So I found it incredibly educational and it upped my own critical appraisal skills. It made me actually think about things in a different way. It made me learn about things in a different way. So yes, it was something extra, but it was something that was enjoyable, fun, working with people from across the globe. So with Victor and with Amita and with Susan and Catherine and yourself. And it was very collaborative. And it was very educational and very enjoyable. So I would definitely recommend it. But I definitely feel I've gone away with more questions after it, for my own practice and for research questions than I started with.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's good to know that it was an enjoyable process. And we certainly encourage anyone who's listening to get involved as well. So what we've done is next we've asked Victor, Amita and Harriet to pick their favourite paper out of the top 10 and to go through it with us today. So Harriet, would you like to start us off?
So they talked through that in a very controlled way, and their results actually only found 3 RCTs or randomised controlled trials in this area, which again highlights the lack of evidence or the lack of trials in the pre-hospital field. The 3 trials we talked about, so the Prehoplio in France, a multi-centre phase 2 randomised controlled trial looking at Lyoplasm versus crystalloid infusion, had 68 patients in. Combat, an American trial based in 2018, a phase 2 unicentre trial, 65 patients, had 28 mortality as an outcome using FFP. And PAMPA, a multi-centre phase 3 trial pre-hospital FFP versus standard of care, which actually had 230 patients in. They put all of these into their analysis, and actually overall they found that the difference between plasma and standard care had no difference in 24-hour mortality or 30-day mortality or multi-organ failure, which again, when we're thinking about the kind of pathophysiology behind it, perhaps doesn't make sense when you're thinking about the inflammatory response, endothelial reaction, hyperfibrinolysis, and the potential effects of plasma on those things. They also adjusted for transport time from a pre-hospital perspective, that's particularly important and was talked about in the PAMPA trial. And again, found no difference in those endpoints of mortality, but did find a decreased incidence in multi-organ failure with a slightly longer transport time, similar to that potentially in PAMPA, which had a 20-minute cutoff for benefit of pre-hospital plasma. So the primary outcomes across those 3 trials, no difference with plasma versus standard care for mortality outcomes at 24 hours, 30 days and multi-organ failure. However, they did in their secondary analysis find that there was a decreased volume of packed red cells in the plasma group and an increased INR on hospital arrival, which we'll talk about shortly. And importantly, there was equivalence in safety outcomes. So for any intervention, especially in the blood transfusion world, thinking about efficacy, but also thinking about safety of that intervention is hugely important. So safety-wise, difference in outcomes. When we talk briefly about how well conducted this systematic review was, they have included RCTs.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Alison. And I think, again, picking up on the fact that we've already said, I think all the papers were super interesting. So choosing any one is no disrespect to the ones you didn't pick. And they've all, educated us and broadened our horizons. But the one I chose to discuss was a systematic review of pre-hospital plasma by Mohamed Abulazam et al, entitled The Efficacy and Safety of Pre-Hospital Plasma in Patients at Risk for Hemorrhagic Shock, an updated systematic review and meta-analysis of randomised controlled trials. And I chose this partly because it's an area that I'm particularly interested in, but also partly because the pre-hospital area, we know it's slightly more challenging to conduct RCTs. So I think seeing what's happened in that area and where the future avenues for research are is really important. The team published a review, put it into context. They talked a bit about the potential physiological benefits of plasma and why it might be beneficial and the rationale for this systematic review. So they talked very well about the rationale that plasma might have benefits on endothelial response to injury, on endothelial cell permeability, and on things like the inflammatory response to injury, which we know are areas of active research. They talked a bit about hyperfibrinolysis and how plasma might benefit that, and how the coagulopathy associated with trauma might be mediated by plasma. But then they started to pick up on the recent trials that have been published, so COMBAT, PAMPA and PREOPLIO, which are the three trials that ultimately ended up in their review. In their terms of their primary outcomes, they were looking at 24-hour mortality, 30-day mortality, and the incidence of multi-organ failure. And they found no difference between plasma and the standard of care, which was crystalloid. And they adjusted for time to hospital, to transport time, again, no impact on mortality, but there was a decreased incidence of multi-organ failure with that prolonged transport time, which fits in slightly with PAMPA, PAMPA's results, but query an underlying mechanism, we're not quite sure why that is. Interestingly, their secondary outcomes, in terms of 24-hour PET red cells, there was a decreased volume and number of PET red cells given for those who have plasma pre-hospital, and that raised INR on hospital arrival. Importantly, there were no safety differences between any of the two arms, so plasma arm or control arm, mainly crystalloid. So if we're thinking of a blood component intervention, sepsis, adverse outcomes, lung injury, all equivalent across the two arms. So we know that the pre-hospital plasma was safe, but questions still remain about its effectiveness. And I think we're going to talk about the strengths and limitations of the trial in our discussion.
Yeah. So thanks for summarising that. So yeah, perhaps you want to start off with saying what you think the strengths and limitations are of the trial?
Yeah, so I think from a strengths perspective, it was a well-conducted systematic review. They only included RCTs, which we'll talk about afterwards, but they analysed those in a comprehensive way. Their main risk of bias was from a deviation from protocol on an intention to treat analysis. But they understood that that was part of the trial design and commented on it and commented in their discussion. All the studies were recent, it was all registered and the analysis was appropriate. And they also commented that although they undertook a meta-analysis, they were slightly limited by the number of trials including that and the heterogeneity of patients including that. Which brings on to the limitations. I guess the fewer number of patients, three trials, means fewer patients able to be included in any meta-analysis. There was heterogeneity in the study populations, in the plasma products used, either fresh frozen plasma or lyoplasm, as well as the standard of care, which we, in all three trials, was crystalloid. And I guess one of the big questions is crystalloid an appropriate comparator? And for me, the other limitation was the outcome measures used. And Victor and I have done work on this previously about whether 24-hour, 30-day mortality are appropriate outcome measures for pre-hospital trials into traumatic hemorrhage. So I guess for me, those are the outstanding questions about an otherwise well-conducted trial with a limited number of randomised controlled trials to include in it.
Yeah. And as an emergency clinician, what is your experience of using, I guess, pre-hospital blood products and particularly pre-hospital plasma? Do you use it on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so within the UK, pretty much every pre-hospital critical care service uses a plasma product, whether that's pre-thawed fresh frozen plasma or freeze-dried plasma, lyoplasm. And that has now become standard of care. So red blood cells and a plasma product is standard of care pre-hospital. I guess that is the argument about this systematic review is that the comparator arm was crystalloid, but we routinely use plasma. And actually, I think everyone feels it is beneficial. So it's interesting that the result of this trial is that its effect on primary outcomes was actually not there on 24-hour or 30-day mortality, but that was plasma in isolation rather than plasma and red cells.
Yeah. And do you think this systematic review will change local practice?
I think at the moment, from a pre-hospital perspective, we have all come to the conclusion, independently of services, that red cells and plasma is now the standard of care. So I don't think this review on its own will change practice. I think the interesting things to bring out of it are a mechanistic and then tying that in with a clinical aspect of plasma. And as I said, there's only 3 randomized controlled trials with this. So again, more research, looking at potentially different outcome measures, which are potentially more appropriate to a pre-hospital intervention with an outcome measure that is both patient and clinician-centered.
Yep. It's interesting. So we'll watch this space, I guess. So thanks, Harriet, for that. Victor, next on my list. So do you want to go through your paper?
Thanks, Alison. Absolutely. So my top paper was the UK REBOA trial, which was published in JAMA in October last year, with the first author being Professor Jan Jansen from the Centre for Injury Science at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. As many would know, REBOA stands for Resuscitative Endovascular Balloon Occlusion of the Aorta. It's a novel technique that involves inserting an intravascular catheter via the femoral artery into the aorta. The balloon can then be inflated either in the descending thoracic aorta, what they call zone 1, or the infrarenal aorta before the bifurcation of the aorta, which they call zone 3, to occlude blood flow and theoretically stop bleeding at sites distal to the balloon occlusion until the patient can be taken to theatre. Now, although large animal studies have shown REBOA to be highly effective in limiting hemorrhage and maintaining cerebral myocardial perfusion in the setting of traumatic bleeding from within the torso, the evidence for REBOA in humans prior to the UK REBOA trial has been limited to case series and cohort studies with largely divergent results. What's more, despite the lack of robust evidence, there are military clinical practice guidelines and a position statement from the American College of Emergency Physicians and the American College of Surgeons recommending the use of REBOA for traumatic life-threatening hemorrhage below the diaphragm when the patient is in hemorrhagic shock, unresponsive to resuscitation or in cardiac arrest. In this setting, the UK REBOA trial was the first randomized control trial that sought to answer the question of whether the addition of REBOA to standard care in the emergency department could reduce mortality in trauma patients with torso hemorrhage. This was a pragmatic, open-label, Bayesian group sequential randomized clinical trial conducted at 6 major trauma centres in the UK. Patients aged 16 years or older with hemorrhage originating from within the torso were eligible for inclusion. Patients were excluded if they were known or thought to be pregnant or had injuries that were clearly not survivable. Between October 2017 and March 2022, a total of 90 patients were enrolled in this UK REBOA trial. 46 were randomised to receive REBOA and standard care, and 44 were randomised to receive standard care alone. One patient in the standard care alone group declined to consent for continued participation 4 days after enrolment. So only 89 patients were included in the final analysis. In terms of baseline characteristics, 69% of the patients were male and 97% had experienced blunt trauma. The median age was 41 years. Overall, the groups were well matched, although notably, patients in the REBOA group were more likely to be hypertensive with a median systolic blood pressure of 84 versus 99 in the standard care group, and also have a higher abbreviated injury scale score for the head region. So the primary outcome was all-cause mortality at 90 days. And among the 89 patients at 90 days, 54% of patients in the REBOA group died compared to 42% in the standard care group. The odds ratio for mortality at 90 days was 1.58 for patients in the REBOA group. And even with multivariable regression to adjust for the differences in baseline characteristics, the odds of 90-day mortality in the REBOA group still remained higher with an odds ratio of 1.80. The probability that the addition of REBOA reduces mortality by a worthwhile margin at 90 days was 3.7%, and the survival curves, if you look at the paper's figures, showed an early separation of the two groups, with an early decline in survival within the REBOA group compared to the standard care group, likely due to a delay or failure to definitively control hemorrhage as a result of REBOA insertion or during attempts at REBOA insertion in the ED. There were more deaths due to bleeding in the REBOA group compared to the standard care group, with all of these deaths occurring within 24 hours and most within 3 hours of randomization. Because of the excess early deaths, fewer patients in the REBOA group underwent a definitive hemorrhage control procedure. And for those who did undergo such a procedure, it took an average of an additional 19 minutes to commence these procedures. Also likely because of the excess early deaths, patients in the REBOA group had fewer hospital-free and ICU-free days. And so based on these results, the authors of the UK REBOA trial concluded that in trauma patients with exsanguinating hemorrhage, the addition of REBOA to standard care in the ED does not reduce and may in fact increase mortality. I think the UK REBOA trial had several strengths, and the authors are to be commended for their efforts in planning, preparing and executing a randomised controlled trial in such a demanding setting where the patients are quite literally on the brink of death from traumatic hemorrhage. The trial design was pragmatic, with simple inclusion criteria based on the clinical judgment of experienced clinicians, allowing them to quickly determine suitability for the trial in a pressured clinical setting. The trial also used routinely collected data in the clinical setting, which no doubt minimised the burden on staff. But the trial had several limitations that complicate the interpretation of the trials, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the discussion.
Thank you, Victor. I also thought it was a really well-written paper and really easy to kind of, well, to read and to understand from somebody who doesn't really know much about that area. So I'm glad you chose that paper because it was a nice one to read myself. But I just wanted to ask, my first question was, were you surprised by the findings of the trial? Because obviously we like trials where there is a positive finding for the intervention, but in this trial, it showed that REBOA and standard care may not reduce, but actually could increase mortality. So were you surprised by those findings?
Yeah, I can't say I was surprised by the findings. I think as I mentioned, the evidence for use of REBOA for traumatic torso hemorrhage in humans has always been conflicting. And the results of the UK REBOA trial actually consistent with a number of previously published observational studies, including two retrospective studies, one from the US and the other from Japan, which reported a possible detrimental effect of REBOA. And I note in the discussion section of the paper, the authors of the UK REBOA trial surmised that the early decline in survival for patients who received REBOA may be related to a delay or failure to definitively control hemorrhage as a result of REBOA insertion or during attempts at REBOA insertion in the emergency department. And indeed, fewer patients in the REBOA group underwent a definitive hemorrhage control procedure. I guess the question is whether the UK REBOA trial has sounded the death knell for REBOA. And I think it's important to recognise, as I was alluding to before, several limitations of the trial that complicate the interpretation of its findings. So I guess first, sample size of the trial was quite small. The trial investigators had originally planned to enrol a total of 120 patients, but the trial was stopped early because the pre-specified stopping rule for harm was met. So only 90 patients ended up being enrolled. And of the 46 patients randomised to the REBOA group, only 19 patients actually received aortic occlusion. And the remaining patients didn't receive aortic occlusion due to a variety of reasons, including improvement or deterioration prior to arterial access, unsuccessful arterial access, or improvement post-arterial access prior to balloon inflation. So that's one. Secondly, I guess there were some significant differences, as I mentioned, in the baseline characteristics of the REBOA and standard care groups in the trial. The REBOA group had lower systolic blood pressure compared to the standard care group, making it questionable whether these patients may have survived regardless of advanced resuscitation. Patients in the REBOA group also had a higher abbreviated injury score, scale score for the head region. And we know that traumatic brain injury itself is associated with mortality. And I guess the other point to make is that REBOA insertion may actually increase blood pressure proximal to the occlusion, exacerbating patients with traumatic intracranial hemorrhages. And I guess the third point to make is that although the trial required clinicians using REBOA to undergo rigorous training, the median time from ED arrival to balloon inflation noted was still 32 minutes, which is a surprisingly long procedure time compared to 12 minutes used by clinicians in the REBOA arrest trial that evaluated REBOA in the non-traumatic out-of-hospital cardiac arrest setting. And this is in the discussion section of the paper. The authors did mention that this is probably related to the relatively low institutional case volume at the centres that participated in the UK REBOA trial compared to other countries, which no doubt would have had an influence on the outcome. And so there were several confounders, I felt, within the UK REBOA trial that may have skewed the results against REBOA. And I guess further trials with larger sample size, accurate patient selection, and rigorous training and retraining for rapid femoral arterial access may still be worthwhile to elucidate the true effects of REBOA.
Another limitation they say is obviously that it's setting in the UK and how relevant or how generalizable that could be to other trauma settings. They cite one of the reasons being that the nature of trauma in the UK is more often blunt force as opposed to penetrating, and what there may have been differences if you saw a different form of trauma or a different percentage of patients with a penetrating rather than blunt force trauma. I don't know enough about this, but do you think there could be differences if there was a different population or in different country settings, potentially, given all the other conversations you've discussions had about the nature of the patient groups, etc.?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I guess in the country that I work, which is Australia, the majority to 90% of major trauma is caused by blunt injury as well, rather than penetrating injury. And this is the focus of actually most of the existing LABOA literature. There was an observational study from the US published in the Journal of American College of Surgeons 2 years ago, which compared outcomes of a large number of patients from the aortic occlusion for resuscitation in trauma and acute care surgery database based on injury type. And this study found that LABOA was significantly less likely to improve or stabilize hemodynamics after penetrating trauma compared to blunt trauma. And the study also found significant differences in the hemorrhage source, the catheter insertion setting, and the deployment zone between the two injury types, which means that the data on the use of LABOA in blunt trauma may not be able to be extrapolated to penetrating trauma. I do think it would be informative to conduct a trial of LABOA in a setting where there is higher incidence of penetrating injuries, stab wounds or gunshot wounds, such as countries like the United States, South Africa, and some of the South American countries.
Thank you.
Really interesting topic and interesting paper as well. It'll be interesting. It'll be good to see sort of where it takes us in the future. Amita, would you like to discuss your favourite paper?
Yes. Thank you, Alison. So the paper which I chose among the shortlisted papers was the ProCoag randomized clinical trial. It was to look at the title of the study was to look at the efficacy and safety of early administration of four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate in patients with trauma at risk of massive transfusion. So this was a trial which was conducted in the trauma centers of France. And the question that the authors have asked is, does four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate reduce 24-hour blood product consumption in patients with trauma at risk of massive transfusion? So just to give you a background, we all know management of severe bleeding in trauma remains a challenge, particularly because of the high incidence of trauma-induced coagulopathy. So there have been studies use of tranexamic acid, reducing the fluid expanders, use of high-ratio blood product transfusions, and expedient hemorrhage control. Then trials of fixed ratio blood product transfusions, use of viscoelastic testing, combination of these all have been tried in the trauma settings. There have been several observation studies also, which have shown that early administration of the four-factor PCC reduces the blood product consumption. But there were no randomized control trials. And so this trial was undertaken and it was very well justified. Now coming to the methods, this was a superiority randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial conducted in 12 trauma centers in France. And the authors had registered their study in the clinicaltrials.gov, and they had obtained the ethical review of the study also before starting the study. So coming to the study subjects, the all adult patients, that is more than 18 years of age with trauma, who had been admitted to one of the participating centers and were at risk of receiving massive transfusion, were enrolled in this study. So at risk, they defined as transfusion of at least one unit of PRBC during the pre-hospital care or within 1 hour of admission, or an assessment of blood consumption score of at least 2, or a clinical assessment by the attending physician of continuing massive transfusion. And massive transfusion was defined as administration of at least 3 PRBC units within 1 hour of admission, or at least 10 RBC units within 24 hours. Then they define acute traumatic coagulopathy as prothrombin ratio more than 1.2. And they had excluded also a few patients, that were those who had undergone traumatic cardiac arrest before the randomization could be done, patients who were expected to die within the first hour of admission, then patients who were already on anticoagulants, already having a terminal condition, known pregnancy, known hypersensitivity, etc., were excluded from this study. And it was, I think, a very well conducted study, because the randomization and blinding, all the team members involved in the care of the patient remained blinded to the treatment assignment. And the randomization was performed within 1 hour of admission. So they did randomization in blocks stratified by the center of care. Now coming to the intervention was either using the four-factor PCC at a dose of 25 international units of factor 9 per kilogram, given at 1 ml per kilogram. And the placebo was an equal dose, that is 1 ml per kilogram of 0.9% normal saline solution. And both were stored in the refrigerator as opaque syringes. And it was identified only by the unblinded nurse. And it was transfused at the same rate. Resuscitation management was similar across the group of patients. They followed the European recommendations. Then coming to the outcome, as a primary outcome, they looked at the total number of blood product units that were transfused within the 24 hours after arrival in the trauma bay. For the secondary outcomes, they looked at the individual blood component units consumed within the first 24 hours, the time how much it took to reduce the prothrombin ratio to less than 1.5, the time to hemorrhage control, the 24 hours and the 28-day mortality, the intensive care unit free days, ventilator free days, hospital free days, and hospitalization status at 28 days. Coming to the sample size estimation, they have used the previous data and they found that to have a substantial reduction of 3 units per 24 hours or a decrease of 25% in 24 hours is the clinically significant difference. So they have used a software and they have also used a Mann-Whitney test, and they have estimated the sample size as 162 patient samples in each group. And with this, they were able to have an 80% power with a risk of alpha error of 0.05. So totally, they required 324 patients according to this statistical analysis. Now, coming to the statistical analysis, they have after patient enrollment, but before the data analysis, they have again undertaken a Mann-Whitney test to confirm the time spent in the study did not differ substantially between the two groups to prevent the survivor bias and to ensure same exposure time to the received blood products. So coming to the results, a total of 4,313 patients were initially admitted with trauma and they were at risk of receiving a massive transfusion. Of this, 3,963 patients did not meet the inclusion criteria. 350 patients were eligible. Of this, again, they found that 23 patients had to be excluded. And ultimately, they had 327 patients who were randomized as 165 patients to the arm receiving the four-factor PCC and 162 to receive the placebo. The demographic profile and the baseline investigations did not differ between the two groups. And they found that the total product consumption at 24 hours was not different between the two groups. The individual product consumption also was not different between the two groups. And a linear regression model found no difference between the PCC and the placebo administration. Then they found that the number of thromboembolic events was 56 numbers in the four-factor PCC out of the 164 patients, and in the placebo it was 37 out of the 160 patients. So it was, numbers were more in the four-factor PCC group, and this was found to be statistically significant also. So they concluded that in this superiority randomized trial involving 324 patients, there was no difference in the total 24-hour blood product consumption among the patients treated either with four-factor PCC versus the placebo. More thromboembolic events were found to occur in the four-factor PCC group. Therefore, the findings do not support the administration of four-factor PCC in patients with trauma who are at risk of massive transfusions. They've also listed their limitations of the study, which shall I discuss?
Thank you very much, Meeta, for that really, really thorough summary of the paper. I was wondering, based on that, how do you think the findings of the study might change practice? And will that vary according to where you are in the world?
Yes. So this four-factor PCC is now widely used in all the trauma settings in massively bleeding patients. It is used left and right. So I think this is a very eye-opener study. And because it's a very well-conducted study, very well thought out and very well-conducted study, blinding the investigators, the outcomes of the study needs to be taken in the right sense. So I think blindly giving four-factor PCC is just going to increase the thromboembolic complications, as is already documented by the observational studies, and it is not going to reduce the blood product consumption. So I think this is a practice-changing study which needs to be brought out and has to be implemented. It will be a practice-changing study.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I did have one question as well. The study excluded participants who were known to have received anticoagulants prior to injury. I don't know how common it is that you would know, so how likely it is that they've excluded all the patients who received anticoagulants. And also, do you think that it's still a relevant question to ask where patients have definitely received anticoagulants?
Exactly. Yes, so that they have done very correctly, I think, because this study has looked at the efficacy and the safety of the four-factor PCC. So when it comes to the efficacy, if the patients are already on anticoagulants, now for the safety purpose, they have looked how much time it took for the prothrombin ratio to come down to below 1.2 to 1.5. So when the patient is already on anticoagulants, we do not know what type of anticoagulants they may be taking. It may be either warfarin, it may be the directly acting oral anticoagulants. And what is the influence of these on the prothrombin time? We are actually not very sure. So to exclude these patients in conditions where we do not know the effect, it is the best practice, I think. So that is why this study becomes even more important. And I think it's they have not used the viscoelastic testing, which is not usually available in all centers. So that is also one point which favors in the applicability of this trial to our clinical practice.
Thank you very much. That's really interesting to hear. Thank you.
So thank you to Victor, Amisha and Harriet for discussing their papers. I guess we just wanted to finish off with a quick discussion just with everyone in the panel involved. I think Susan and Catherine have some questions for our reviewers. Susan, do you want to go first?
So I was just interested to find out, obviously you've picked your top three each, pick your top one each of you, but were there any other notable papers from the roundup that you wanted to, that you would have liked to have picked, or you want to just comment on now?
So I think for me, we've all touched upon identification of patients and how we select the right patient group. So I think there was one paper that was in the top 10 that I thought was super interesting in terms of future avenues of research and identifying patients, which was the paper by Oakley about AI and predicting who might need pre-hospital or in-hospital blood transfusion. Because we've talked about the inclusion criteria along these three trials and within all the trials that are in the roundup. But I still don't think we truly know who benefits. So using AI, using different methodologies to predict who might be in need of blood components, I think would be absolutely key going forwards.
So Victor, did you have another paper that you thought was really interesting?
Yeah. So there was a paper discussing the cold stored platelets in trauma patients, use of cold stored platelets. Yeah. So that also I found it was interesting paper. And another paper was based on the hypocalcemia, pre-admission hypocalcemia. So this looked at the pre-admission hypocalcemia in patients who have received transfusions and who have not received. So we make a big issue out of the citrate causes hypocalcemia. But actually this trial, they found that hypocalcemia caused is very negligible amount of hypocalcemia, and it is not a statistically significant one. So that also, I think it's not a practice-changing paper, but the outcome of that paper is like, supports what we always tell, that the citrate causes only mild degree of hypocalcemia in patients who have got a well-functioning liver. So that was supporting what we generally tell. So to our clinicians, this paper can be a good evidence.
Well, sometimes it's nice to have papers, isn't it, where actually it supports current practice. Not all papers are going to be able to change practice, but actually supporting current practice is important to recognise and to benchmark again, etc.
Yes.
And Victor, I don't know if we have time for this, but I'm going to say, was there any other papers that you thought were very interested in?
Yeah, I think for me, there were some of the other notable papers include, I guess, one, the CRYSTAT-2 trial, which was led by Davenport, showed that amongst patients with trauma and bleeding who required activation of a major hemorrhage protocol, the addition of early and empirical high-dose cryoprecipitate to standard care didn't actually improve all-cause 28-day mortality. And the other quite interesting trial that I wanted to highlight was a trial by Dario et al. Involving 365 college students examining the effects of cognitive aids on point-of-care hemorrhage control skills in lay people. And that trial found that the use of a cognitive aid that combined visual and audio feedback can improve bystander hemorrhage control skills, which I found quite interesting.
So that would be that if you came across, as a member of the public, if you came across a trauma setting or trauma situation, you could actually do something to kind of support the patient or the people who had a trauma injury.
Yes, that's correct.
That's really interesting, actually, because, we all know that, we all understand that the what you can do pre-hospital is vitally important to saving somebody's life. So actually, lay people having some understanding would be beneficial.
So I just had, following on from that, really, as we've talked about individual papers that were interesting and we wanted to bring into the roundup discussion, but are there overarching themes that go across the papers? What does it tell us about the sort of state of knowledge within transfusion in trauma at the moment? And I wonder also if Alison would like to weigh in on this too, because you've been part of the screening discussion all the way through.
So I think, from after reviewing all the papers as part of the roundup, I think a few emerging themes that I've identified in transfusion trauma. I think, the resurgence of low titer group O whole blood, with studies continuing to support its safety and multiple prospective and retrospective observational studies suggesting that it may decrease mortality compared with component therapy in adult and pediatric trauma patients and those receiving massive transfusion. And I guess to the use of lower transfusion thresholds, especially in younger trauma patients, with an increasing number of studies showing that having a more conservative target is safe with no increase in adverse outcomes and no difference in functional outcomes, but possibly comes with the benefit of lower infection rate. And I think the other themes there was one paper dealing with the use of plasma biomarkers to identify different molecular endotypes of trauma patients, hospital of arrival, to guide choice of resuscitation strategy. And I guess comes with the aim of achieving some level of precision in our transfusion approaches.
I think Victor has highlighted what are the outcomes, like better things that we have come across in this roundup. So some of the things that were overhyped, for example, the use of this four-factor PCC, which is used left and right in all hemorrhages without analyzing the causes. Similarly, the hypocalcemia, the citrate-induced hypocalcemia, which is so thought about and so talked about, that also, like, evidence is coming up that it is not so much relevant as we used to think or our clinicians used to think. So these were also some of the evidences which have come out of this transfusion roundup.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with both Victor and Amita. It was I think the papers could broadly be divided into, there were a lot of papers on sort of acute interventions such as the REBOA, but other interventions as well that can help potentially, improve outcomes of these trauma patients and maybe even influence their transfusion needs. And we did discuss a lot about whether to include these papers because those acute interventions per se weren't really transfusion interventions like the REBOA. But ultimately we decided it was pretty important for the overall theme, which was transfusion in trauma, because they can impact on blood product usage. And then, like Amita said, it was good to see some papers looking at practices which are sort of widely done for many years, perhaps without robust evidence behind them, just done because it's always been done. So it's good. I think it's always important in those settings to make sure that we do have some evidence behind them, to support the use or, discourage its use in the future. Yeah,
definitely. It's been a really revealing kind of discussion across the papers. Mm.
Yep.
And I think so much of transfusion research is about how can you support transfusion, strategies to support transfusion or alternatives. It's not about transfusion, it's just strategies to support blood use. And we are very clear and very aware that blood use is a pressing issue around the world, blood availability is a pressing issue around the world, and actually having products or techniques that can support its use is actually crucially important to the transfusion research agenda anyway.
Yeah, definitely. to ultimately improve patient outcomes, I guess. So thank you, everybody. Thanks to our reviewers. Thanks to my co-chair, Susan and Catherine, for this podcast. Hopefully all of our audience has enjoyed it, and you've enjoyed hearing about the various papers as well. Remember that the top 10 paper list and the PICO summaries are available via the ISBT website. And if you're listening and you want to get involved in the next roundup, then please do sign up via the ISBT website. We're always looking for volunteers. So thank you, everybody.